Hello, I'm Fred Stella, president of the Interfaith Dialogue Association. Welcome to another edition of Common Threads. The world of interfaith is often seen as one big kumbaya moment. People of all religions holding hands and praying for world peace together. And yes, that is one side of the interfaith movement, but it's really much broader than that. And it's important that we acknowledge the other side that really gets its hands dirty in matters of serious disagreements, in those times when religion and politics meld into one another, when you can't always be as polite as you might want to be, and when you know that no matter what you do, someone is going to be offended. Our guest today is one such person. He's someone who is in the front lines of the challenges facing societies that claim pluralism but practice something altogether different. Dr. Richard Benkin is an American Jewish human rights activist. He's co-founder of Interfaith Strength. He's associated with organizations like Islam Israel Fellowship. He's a journalist, writer, and lecturer. He's also a member of Folks Magazine Editorial Board, and he's authored various books, including one coming out in a few months titled, What is Moderate Islam? His academic credentials include time spent teaching at DePaul University, Roosevelt University, and the University of Pennsylvania. So we welcome to Common Threads Dr. Richard Benkin. Hello, Richard.
Hello, Fred. Thank you so much.
Certainly, certainly. Pleasure to have you here.
Pleasure is mine.
Very quickly, you said recently that in Jewish thought, there is no doctrine of placing another people or religion below you, you meaning Judaism.
Correct.
How does that square with the understanding of being a chosen people?
That's a great question, although I'll qualify my remarks by first saying I'm not a religious scholar or a rabbi. I believe I'm a knowledgeable layman, however. And my response to that would be that from a Jewish perspective, being chosen means to us that we have a great many responsibilities. It's not privilege. It's not pats on the back. It's responsibilities. We have to be a light unto the nations, as our saying goes. And there's a midrash. It's called. It's a story that we have in our culture and comes from our holy books. Stories are spun from it. And this one goes that when God was looking for some people who would be his chosen people, who would carry out the obligations, who would spread his word, things of that nature, he went to all the peoples on earth, every group, every ethnicity or faith you could think of, and they all refused. And so finally, I guess he was scraping the bottom of the barrel. Finally, the last group he came to were the Jews. And figuring that he was turned down by the others, the story goes that God, being almighty, lifted up a mountain and held it over our heads and said, so tell me, do you want this job? Do you want to do this? And, of course, we said, we'll do it. So, in other words, the meaning of the story is that, look, there are other peoples who have equal qualifications. It's not that we're special in that regard. And we're no different than the people who refused. We had a mountain over our head, and obviously it's a difficult decision. So it's not quite the one-to-one relationship that people tend to think of when they think of the concept of chosen people. Just chosen to carry out these obligations. And, of course, there are other peoples who have additional obligations.
Certainly. When did you begin your interfaith work?
I mean, you could say there's always been some of that in my life as a child, as a student. I was always involved in those sorts of events. Primarily, and this is something that I think is important, and When I would, you know, back in the day, when I would, when I was a student or a child, when people thought of interfaith, they generally thought of, oh yeah, Jews and Christians. And so there were, at least there was some of that there. I also, in my Jewish education, we spoke about other faiths and in a very positive way too, particularly Islam, as being a rigorously monotheistic faith. However, in terms of what I do now, it really took off. I had done something, but it really took off in 2003 when a Muslim journalist from Bangladesh contacted me and said that the people in his country get a very biased information about Israel and the Jews, and then ultimately it also extended to Americans in general. As a journalist, he said he wanted to change that, and he had read some of my blog posts and things of that nature, and particularly what I'd written about Israel, and said, geez, you know, maybe this guy can help us get additional information sources. And of course, when someone asks you something like that, how can you say no? It's what we Jews would call a mitzvah, and it's an opportunity. So we started working together. I learned so much about him, about Islam, about Bangladesh. I was able to get him additional sources of information. He helped me get published in the Bangladeshi papers.
Well, wait, real quick, Richard. Why you, of all of the people in the world to contact, you must have been doing something. He didn't just pick you out of a phone book, right?
Right. Yeah, I'd been writing blog posts about primarily in support of Israel. And I suppose he had read them and was impressed with the depth of the knowledge, certainly with the perspective. And he asked me. My guess is he also asked others, but perhaps others didn't have a mountain held over their head, and I guess I didn't need one.
So you were a chosen person for this particular effort.
You know, it's funny you use those words, because exactly the way I understood things was I was chosen to have responsibilities.
Yes, yes. So continue with your story. You make this contact with this Bangladeshi journalist.
Yeah, and so we developed a friendship. A Jew and a Muslim. Of course, there are so many times when it seems that such friendships are not possible, would be based on lie or deceit, but we developed a true friendship. Then in 2003, the end of November, December 2003, it was December 1st, 2003, someone he had contacted previously had arranged for him to address a meeting of writers in Tel Aviv. And Bangladesh has no relations with Tel Aviv. No relations with Israel. Even though Israel was actually the fourth country in the world to recognize Bangladeshi independence. So there's no direct flight. There's no Israeli embassy or consulate. So we helped arrange for him to pick up a visa in Bangkok. And so he was all set to go on flight from Dhaka to Bangkok and then from Bangkok to Tel Aviv. When he got to the airport, he was seized, his bags were ransacked, and he was taken away to a place of solitary confinement inside the airport and kept for hours without food or drink. And if anyone's ever been to Dhaka, Bangladesh, it's always hot. He was kept there, and I expect that during the time of his being held, somehow word got out to some people that he had never made his flight. And so many hours later, when the Bangladeshi police were going to move him from the airport to the central jail in Dhaka, the capital, his brother had come to find things out. He was at the airport when they brought him out. As they were taking him away, he said to his brother, yelled out to his brother, call Dr. Benkin in America. Tell him to please help me. Again, how can you say no? How can you turn your back? Even if he wasn't someone I had already felt a friend. How can you just say, "Nah, I think I'll go watch another Seinfeld rerun or something like that instead"? Of course not. And so that's what really propelled me into the work that I do. And so, well, you know, what do? I'd never done anything like this before. So I went back to the computer, sent out emails, called people. I can be very persistent, very annoying, I guess, and just kept bringing the matter to people's attention. Before I get to what happened, though, one of the most interesting things for me was during that whole process, I encountered so many people, so many different backgrounds, so many faiths, so many different political perspectives, and because I was looking to see how can I get support to save this poor man, what I began to realize was how you see the commonalities. You recognize the things that you share, not the things that separate you. And so that's really what got me started and what really propelled me into what I do.
Real quick, what was the government's concern over? And his name was Chaudhry, right?
That's right, Shoaib Chaudhry. The formal reason they gave was that he was going to violate the law by going to Israel. It's a ridiculous ruse. And unfortunately, there were gullibles, particularly in our government, who believed it. But because there's a 500 taka fine for taka being the currency in Bangladesh. There's a 500 taka fine for that offense.
For going to Israel.
Yes, and it's equal to about $7.50. He had also served, I think, in lieu of that, you can sit in jail for 30 days, and by that time he had served that and more. So that surely wasn't it. They ended up charging him with blasphemy and sedition. And the basic rationale was that he was hurting Bangladesh in the eyes of the world because he had written about the rise of radical Islam there, and that he was hurting Bangladesh by speaking up for what they consider an enemy nation, and was going to they fabricated an article supposedly he had written that was ultimately disproven. But anyway, that's what he was charged with. That was their concern. And I think, again, just from a point of view of any of us, for a journalist to be taken away, charged with capital offense for writing about something is pretty scary. But it does happen. And again, in terms of getting your hands right, that we have to continue to fight against that.
If you're just joining us, you're listening to Common Threads here on WGVU-FM. I'm Fred Stella, and with me today, Dr. Richard Behnken. He is an American Jewish human rights activist and co-founder of Interfaith Strength. So, back to your story here with Mr. Chaudhry. You ended up being very instrumental in getting him out of prison. Am I correct?
Correct.
And what processes? You said you got involved with people of various faiths. I don't necessarily need names, but perhaps organizations or who in the government might have helped you out here.
Okay, very good. In terms of organizations, there really were no faith organizations per se that joined the cause. It was just individuals. It was people, and it didn't matter what their faith were. I mean, of course, there were other Jews, there were Muslims, there were Christians, there were Hindus, there were Baha'i, there were Buddhists. I'm sorry if I've neglected to mention some because there were just a ton. So it was more just at a person-to-person level. However, when you ask about the government, that really is the key, because what happened was, so part of what I did was to try and get people to know what was going on and to write things or say things about it. Because I think we know that when people commit human rights abuses, it is in part due to the fact that they believe no one knows or no one will care. And that's, I had to change that. So that was one part. But the second part was, I realized, look, I'm just a guy. I'm no one with a great deal of clout or wealth or anything like that. So I had to find someone who was. And being an American citizen, I thought to myself, my goodness, this is such a terrible violation of the values that we hold dear that our government needs to know about it. And the form that that took was I wrote my congressman. At that time, Congressman Mark Kirk, he's now Senator Mark Kirk of Illinois running for re-election. And so I remember I would just keep writing. I would write like every other day, just keep writing letters, keep writing letters. At one point, one of his senior staff called me and said, and this was probably towards the end of 2004 that he called me, and said, listen, just want you to know, we're getting your emails. You know, it's not just the formal response. We're getting them. We're reading them. We're becoming familiar with this issue. I said, oh, are you asking me to stop writing? He said, no, keep writing, because we wanted to remain in the forefront of what we talk about here. And then in January of 2005, he said, he called me again. This gentleman named Jeff Phillips. He called and said, as the beginning of the year following election, Congressman Kirk would always get his staff together and say, gee, what are the things that we should make sure we do this term? And he said that this was going to be one of the things that he was going to push. So a couple months later, I got a call from him and said that he said that Congressman Kirk asked me if I'd be available to come to his office on the 8th of April, 2005. He had summoned the Bangladeshi ambassador to the U.S. For a meeting that day, and we were going to do something about this. So I did. Interestingly, because the good guys weren't the only people I was writing to. When the ambassador to Bangladesh walked in the room and congressman introduced me, he wasn't looking at me and turned around and said, oh, Dr. Bacon, you figure very prominently in our daily briefings, which again told me, you know, you just got to keep at it and keep at it and keep at it, and something's going to get through, even if you're, as I would always describe, just a guy. So So I got to the meeting early Friday morning on April 8th. I got to the office. The meeting was at 11 o'clock a.m. And shortly after I got there, his scheduler, Mark Scheduler, came out and said, I just got a call from the Bangladesh Embassy. The ambassador sends his regrets, but he's going to be busy at that time and so can't make the meeting. So Mark Kirk said to her, look, you get the ambassador. You get the ambassador back on the phone, and you tell him that I said this. We're meeting today. I don't care if it's 11 o'clock at night. We're meeting today. Now, you give me a time when you can be here. And he said, if you need me to get on the phone, I will. Anyway, they did that. And another interesting story, he couldn't make it till 5 p.m. And so Mark said to me, listen, Richard, I know you need to be back by sundown. And this is Washington. I live in Chicago. And I had arranged to have a plane take me back immediately after the meeting. And he said, but I really would love to have, really need you in this meeting, because you really are the expert on this. So I said to him, and this is another thing, I don't know how many of your listeners know this, it's another thing about Judaism. I said, Mark, I know you're not Jewish, but I know a lot of your constituents are. So you might know that Jewish law will tell you that not only can you, but you must violate any legal ritual, any legal provision. I mean, I'm sorry, any religious ritual or provision. You must violate it if it means saving a life. And I said, and I think that's what we're doing. In fact, he said, thank you. I arranged to stay over at my hotel. His staff helped me reschedule with the airlines for the next evening. And so we held the meeting. And again, what Mark said was great. He said, look, I need to run the show. I want him to see that this is coming from someone, you know, in the U.S. government, he said. But Richard, if the ambassador misspeaks, feel free to jump in, which ended up defining a lot of the conversation. And we had a tremendous meeting. It got very acrimonious at times. I believe the ambassador was not intentionally lying. He actually is a pretty decent guy, I think.
But however, he's paid to.
Exactly. Exactly right. And he was reading the talking points that his government gave him. What he didn't realize is a lot of people think that we Americans are pretty naive and we get all our information from the movies. What he wasn't expecting was that when he did misstate facts, I had evidence to show that's not true, and I would jump in and say, well, you know, that's not really true, is it? And then I would provide the evidence. For instance, he was saying that Shoaib was getting medical treatment. He was not, and the man had developed a really severe eye ailment in prison, which he still suffers from. So there were a number of things. I had evidence of physical mistreatment from some of those former guards. So there were just any number of things we were able to jump in on. And when, again, he also brought up that matter, oh, it was just because he violated this rule about not traveling to Israel. And again, I was able to quote the law, the Bangladeshi law, to him. So we had a meeting that started out acrimonious. And in fact, at one point, they said, okay, fine. He said, okay, we'll give him bail. My government said, we'll give him bail. And he looked at me, and I said, not good enough. Because if he is only out on bail, he knows he has to, quote-unquote, behave himself, or he could be charged again or reincarcerated. So we went through it some more. The nature of the bail kind of changed. I couldn't get a complete he was not empowered to give a complete completely annul the charges. But we did some pretty good work together afterwards, and although there were several times to reincarcerate him, I was able to stop it. One even by notorious secret police, the Rapid Action Battalion, or RAB. We were able to free him from them after they captured him. So it was an incredibly intense time. And I have to tell you, I feel very, very fortunate that Mark Kirk is the type of person he is, that our government allows people in a position of power to actually do things to benefit their constituents, and in fact, people who are not their constituents, like Shoaib. Now, I might say, just be complete, that several years later, for reasons unrelated to the initial involvement, Shoaib and I had a parting of the ways. And since that time, he's recently actually been incarcerated, first on an unrelated charge, and then once they had him, they brought this charge again and just added to his sentence. So, however, the freeing him, the initial interaction with the Bangladeshi government, and several other things have made real changes for us there.
That's great. I commend you for all of your efforts. That's wonderful. And Richard, we only have a couple of minutes left, but I do want you back again next week, because this is a fascinating conversation. There's so much more to get to.
Absolutely.
Let me know, if people are interested in your work, what's the best place online to find you?
Yeah, I have a personal website, and the address is www.interfaithstrength. That's one word, interfaithstrength.com.
Okay.
And I generally update it monthly. I really I don't have a staff. I don't have people to do it for me. That's pretty much what I'm able to do. But I keep all the articles that I've written and about the different stuff. They're all there. And I also say people can also email me. I'm always happy to interact with people through email. I can give you my email as well.
Sure, go ahead.
It's Dr. R. Benkin. That is D-R-R. Benkin, also just one word, at comcast.net.
Okay, wonderful. Well, Richard, it's been a pleasure this week. We'll talk to you next week as well, and enjoy the time in between.
Thank you, Fred. You too. I am so looking forward to it, and thank you so much.
You've been listening to Common Threads here on WGVU. I'm Fred Stella, and today we spoke with Dr. Richard Benkin, an American Jewish human rights activist and the co-founder of Interfaith Strength. Please join us again next week here on Common Threads.